I want to thank the organizers for providing a pointer.
That's kind of
the laser pointer is pathetic. I don't know if anyone noticed that. But as I looked around, I found this, which is apparently left here precisely to serve
There's
as a pointer.
Hmm?
There's one in every room? Oh my God, you guys are brilliant. Okay. All right. So my talk, oh, right. So I'm going to start by thanking you guys for inviting me here. I've never been to the Perimeter Institute before. It's lovely. I could sort of, I'm thinking, how could I stick physics into my work and come back for a visit and spend longer? But I know you're not supposed to criticize your host, but there's one thing I have to bring up. How many of you know what that stands for? That's a Twitter hashtag. No, yes, I think that's part of the problem. I don't know if you've noticed.
Oh, yes.
I would hope you've noticed. It's not enough to notice. This level of female participation in the meeting, level of female invited speakers, is not acceptable. You can do better. Put more effort into saying, are there qualified women? Let's look harder for them. You can find them. And that is really important because the visibility of women drives the expectations and achievements of everybody, of women in particular. But it will also shift your mindset. One thing I've noticed, when people refer to scientists, they say he in this group. He did this. He, just random unknown scientist. What would a scientist do? He would do this. And it sets an expectation that scientists are male. And you have to actively fight this to be fair to women. You have to actively fight this. And one very important way to fight this is at the level of who gets invited to speak at meetings. So I'd love to come back, but with more women. Okay, so my talk is in three parts. The first part is I'm going to retell a story from a few years back. It's a quick story. It has lots of open access, open science issues in it, and it's a fun story. Then I'm going to talk about unintended consequences of open access publishing, particularly a particular thing that one publisher was doing but seems to have corrected now. And I'm going to talk briefly about this and sort of expanding on things I've picked up from yesterday's discussions. So the talk, the part about the arsenic life is in the form of what's called an Ignite talk. It's one of those mini science talk formats. And in this case, I have 20 slides and I have 15 seconds for each slide. It's a 5-minute talk. And these slides are going to advance automatically every 15 seconds, whether I'm ready or not. So it creates a nice tension for you to watch me going, oh my God, oh my God. Okay. So this story is one of yesterday's talks. It's a tragedy in three acts about an obscure bacterium that was lifted to scientific fame and glory and then crashed and burned. And our story starts with space aliens. Everybody loves space. Scientists, we'd love to find space aliens, but it's really, really expensive to look for space aliens in space. But there's another possibility, and that's something that's called the shadow biosphere. That's the hypothesis that in addition to the life that we know, that there are other organisms, either very ancient or even evolved independently on Earth, that have different biology and are sort of Earth aliens we don't know about. Where would we find them? We'd find them in obscure locations, in harsh environments, maybe. We might expect that they would have unusual chemistries, like our science fiction stories, silicon instead of carbon, or arsenic instead of phosphorus. So our story starts with a young postdoctoral fellow who had a NASA fellowship to look for shadow biosphere light. And she looked in the arsenic-rich sediments of California's Mono Lake for bacteria, for organisms that could use arsenic instead of phosphorus. She took sediments, added them to a culture medium to which she provided arsenic, but not phosphate, and just left them in the cupboard for a couple of months. And oh my God, they grew! So exciting. So she contacted other NASA astrobiology-funded researchers who had various high-tech expertise to help her analyze these mysterious organisms. And they were able to culture the organisms, look at them under microscopes, electron microscopes, do all kinds of bizarre biophysical analyses with acronyms that I don't know anything about, resulting in the conclusion that indeed these organisms were using arsenic in place of phosphorus. And oh, paper to science, science accepted it. I'll tell you about the peer reviewers later. NASA was thrilled, called a press conference, sent out a press release, tweeted up a storm. All the media was there, it was televised, and filled all the newspapers. Some of you will remember this brief splash about a new form of life using arsenic instead of phosphorus. And this lasted for about long enough it took the scientists to read the papers, to read the paper. And then there was this outcry, partly triggered or started by a blog post of mine, about all the flaws in the paper and how we don't think this is a valid result at all. So what was wrong? So the first thing was the possibility that the medium was contaminated with phosphate. The authors hadn't taken any precautions to exclude contamination. That's me calculating how much phosphate it would take to explain the growth that they observed. Another problem was that this organism was not a shadow biosphere organism. It turned out, when its DNA was checked, to be part of a relatively well-studied group of bacteria living in mostly harsh, salty environments called halomonads. Another problem was that their purification methods had been less than rigorous, and it wasn't at all clear that the arsenic was actually in the DNA and not in the gel that they analyzed. Finally, the biggest problem at all came from chemistry. Arsenic has a structure quite similar to phosphate, but the bonds it forms are very unstable. DNA with an arsenic backbone is predicted to have a half-life of much less than a second. So there were lots of flaws in the theory. There were lots of flaws in the research. So I set out to try and replicate the results and see if these bacteria really grew. So there's me at the bench figuring out how to work with arsenic. And I did this in part because of open science. I have a research blog where I write about my day-to-day research, and I wanted to write about the research on my blog as I did it. That's me clinging to straws on the precipice of irreproducible results. But eventually, I managed to get the cultures to grow, purified the DNA, sent it to collaborators at Princeton who did mass spec analysis. And we wrote a paper and submitted it to Science, accepted, saying no arsenic in the DNA. So what went wrong here? Well, it's what I call a cascade of fail. Everybody involved in the process failed. The author failed. She fell in love with her hypothesis. So she was totally uncritical about all the obvious methodological flaws. Her supervisor didn't know a lot about, he knew a lot about sort of harsh environment chemistry, but he didn't know any molecular biology really. And he just sort of gave her her head. He didn't supervise. The other authors, of whom there were quite a lot of senior scientists, didn't take any responsibility for the credibility of the rest of the paper. They each contributed their one high-tech analysis and a paragraph of methods and said, check, thank you, I'm an author, check. The reviewers, it turns out you can't actually get peer reviews directly, but Dan Vergano, who was then at USA Today, I think, one thing I discovered science journalists, the good science journalists, are fabulous. Dan Vergano used a Freedom of Information Act request and got not the original reviews, but the rebuttal letter, the response letter from the authors after the initial round of peer review, and which included the authors' responses and the peer reviews. What was shocking was how credulous the reviewers were. They just lapped this up and said, oh, there's a comma missing on page 3. They were terrible. The editors of Science, of course, failed because there were people already raising concern about this, in particular Steve Benner. And NASA, of course, failed very publicly and spectacularly, but didn't bat an eye when they did it. Now, so that's the Ignite talk. And I'm just going to back up a bit and say a few things about the interplay of openness and closedness that was going on, in addition to things I've already mentioned. So the first is that the authors and NASA were initially very in favor of open. Press conference, press release, tweeting up a storm about this great new discovery. But as soon as things went sour, suddenly open science was off the table, and they didn't want to hear anything from bloggers in their pajamas, even if they were top senior scientists. The paper itself was not available unless you had an academic subscription to Science. $20, which is actually cheap as these subscription paywalls go, to read the paper. Once the furor blew up, Science people started saying, what? Why can't we read this paper? And Science backed down and said, oh, okay, we'll let you read it, but you have to give us your email address so we can spam you. The paper was initially published as what they call online early access, where this happens a lot in biology, in fields where people don't normally use a preprint server. The journal, once a paper is accepted, the journal will put an unformatted final version of the paper online so the paper can be read before it actually appears in print in the journal. Normally, for Science, it's about a month between the time the paper appears on the early access page and the time it moves over into the print copy. For this article, it took 6 months of languishing in obscurity. All the other papers that appeared on early access sort of jumped ahead and all got published, and this one still hadn't been published. I had visions of the authors and the editors squabbling in the background about whether they should retract this, but that seems to have not been the case, because when the paper finally appeared, it was accompanied by comments. Now, the paper had abundant public open peer review in Twitter and blogs and all kinds of articles. But the people had also submitted formal critical comments to Science. And those got peer reviewed lightly. And they were published along with the paper. 8 of them were published along with the paper, pointing out a different serious problem with the paper, 8 of them. But the authors' minds were closed. They held fast. We stand by everything we said. We were right. You guys are all wrong. So the funniest thing came after the paper, when we submitted the paper, we posted it on the archive. BioArchive wasn't really active yet, but I knew that, you know, physicists used archive, so I knew that journals like Nature and Science were familiar with it and would allow papers to be submitted and published, even though the preprint was already available. And we waited months and months for once the paper was accepted, we put the final version on the archive, the final unformatted version. Then we waited months and months to find out, when is it going to be published? Finally, I'd been invited to give a public outreach talk at the big evolution meeting. And in July, and I emailed Science and said, oh, what's going on? I want, you know, is this paper going to be out? And I was aware of something called the embargo system, which many of you may not know about. I'm going to tell you. This is something that started with medical journals. So Science, I found, had embargoed our paper until July 26. So the embargo system was a way for journals to control public discussion of papers that they were going that were going to appear in them. And it started with medical journals that were concerned that patients were reading about medical advances in the newspaper before the paper had actually been published, because the authors would call these press releases about their great discoveries, and the patients would be pestering their doctors for these new treatments before the doctor had had a chance to evaluate whether there was any data supporting it. So journalists get advanced copies of the publications, usually a week before they're published, on the condition that they not write anything until the paper appears in the journal. If they break the embargo, they're off the list. They don't get the advance copies anymore. And authors are instructed not to speak to the press except under this condition. And Science and I think other journals have sort of thinly veiled threats to the authors. You know, something bad may happen to your paper if you speak to the press. And that has actually terrorized biologists, biomedical scientists in particular, to the point where they're scared to even mention their paper has been submitted or published. They say, oh, I can't talk about it over lunch, you know, because it's embargoed. But all the rule really says is, don't call a press conference. Make sure that the press knows that they're not supposed to report it until it's published. Anyway, so I told Science I was going to give this big outreach talk, and I was going to say that the paper was in press. And they went, oh, well, really, we'd rather you didn't mention at all that the paper was, you know, even in the works. And I went, eh, sorry, that's not the rules. So I headed off to the meeting to give my talk, and suddenly I start getting calls from journalists because Science has decided to make the paper publicly available after all, because I had pushed back. I mean, I was going to abide by their rules, but I wasn't going to let them change the rules. And they managed to do it in the most dramatic way by arranging to lift the embargo in the middle of my talk. So it was great. I'm going, blah, blah, blah. I get to this point in my talk, and Carl Zimmer's in the audience, and he knows about this. And I say, Carl, is it open yet? He's going, yes, it's open. It was great. So there's more open, close stuff, but I think that's all I have to say about that. Now, this is part two. I want to talk about unintended consequences of being open. And I'll start with an unintended consequence of an open internet, which you may be familiar with. This is from the musical Avenue Q, which is kind of a Sesame Street parody, pointing out that most of the use of the internet turns out to be for porn. And most of the advances in internet technology turn out to result from the fact that most of the use of the internet is for porn. And I don't think this was what the initial developers of the web had in mind, although I could be wrong. So what about open science? Open access publishing is what I want to focus on for a few minutes. And the first of these, what I think is an unintended consequence, is the rise of predatory scientific publishing. I'm sure that physicists as well as biologists are deluged with emails inviting you to publish in disreputable journals with really low publication charges. This is a tiny little excerpt from a list of predatory online publishers. You know, a bit at the A's, a bit at the end. Beale's list has been shut. Beale's a librarian, Jeffrey Beale's a librarian. His list has been shut down, and I don't know why. There was some discussion of it at the time. But it was a great place to check. He wasn't saying this is definitely a predatory journal, but he'd say, be careful, check it out before you publish in it. It probably has the lowest of low editorial standards. So the consequence I want to focus on is a much less well-known, more obscure consequence, but it sheds a lot of light on attitudes and problems. And that's that there's one publisher in particular who is republishing open access articles for profit. That publisher is Apple Academic Press. They're a publisher of academic and professional books. You know, those kind of glossy books that we sometimes edit. We get our colleagues to write articles for them on specialized topics, and then they sell for like $200, and we get a free copy. Our co-authors get a free copy. Hardly anyone else ever buys. The libraries buy them. Anyway, that's the kind of books that they publish. Their business plan, as best I can see, is that they publish polished-looking collections of research articles, mostly, you know, variable quality, we'll call those research articles. They're sold through Amazon and through scientific publishers as ebooks and as print-on-demand books. So they don't print the book until somebody wants to buy it, and then they just print one copy and send it off. The books are also bundled, included in the kind of bundles of books that university librarians buy from jobbers. So I don't know if you realize this, most of the books in a university library were not handpicked by the librarians. They were purchased in like, it's like this guy shows up and says, okay, you need books, here's a nice bag of books. These ones will suit your needs well. And they buy them. That's how university librarians buy most of their books. And most of the books have contents that are edited collections of purpose-written articles, like the books that we're familiar with. And the quality, they're mostly third-world authors and, you know, the editor and the editor's friends, but that's not unusual. The problem is that other books are collections of open-access articles that have been scraped from open-access journals and journals with gold open-access articles. But it's not made clear, actually, I blogged about this a lot, and as a result, a few months ago, I got an email from Apple Academic Press saying, oh, we're trying to clean up our act. Could you change your blog? And they are trying to clean up their act. But in some of these books, most of these books, it was not at all clear that these were open access articles that had been previously published. They looked just the same as the other books. Some of the articles had been edited a little bit. Maybe the title was changed. A bit of the wording was changed for no obvious reason. The authors were listed as contributors to the book, but they had not been informed about this book. They knew nothing about it. And the editors of these books had very little expertise in the field and usually had, you know, they were at a community college running the teaching lab or something, and they had some, you know, maybe they had a PhD 20 years ago in a vaguely related field. So some of this was, I learned about this from a colleague who, using Google's citation tracker thing, which had told her, hey, you've got a new publication, congratulations. And she went, wait, this is a paper that we published 5 years ago in an open access journal. Suddenly it's coming up as a new publication with a slightly different title in a book. And she was outraged. And when I started discussing this with other researchers, they were all outraged that this could happen. So I wonder, this is the kind of books. This is the basic publication information. Prices, you know, $150 up to $200, look like perfectly normal books. Authors, sometimes there would be, at the end of the book, there would be a little section called author's notes, where the fine print would mention where the articles had been previously published, but often there was nothing. So I sent out a survey, and I contacted various scholarly societies to distribute this, mostly biomedical, evolutionary biology, that kind of thing. And this was the description of the situation. Consider this. Several years ago, you published a paper in an open access journal by PLOSR Biomed Central. Now you discover that without your knowledge, your paper has been included as a chapter in a multi-author book. The author list is correct, but the text and title have been edited. You and your co-authors are listed as contributors, but the citation isn't given or hidden. Looks like a typical book, doesn't mention that these have been previously published, it's being sold. And then you discover, when you go back to the original journal, that this republication is basically legal because you agreed to the Creative Commons license that went with publication. So I sent this out. I got about 700 replies. And these are the questions that I asked in the survey. And this is just the percent of people. That's about 80%. I think there's a scale on the next slide. This is the percent of the respondents that agreed with those statements. And the biggest concerns were issues that affected the author's reputation as a scientist, or that affect, I mean, I cast it as reputation, but in fact, they felt that it affected their ability to behave as a responsible, honorable scientist. So I highlighted those. Worrying, they want the original publication to be credited. They don't want the paper to be altered, which is fair because, in fact, according to the CC BY license, papers should not be edited unless the authors are involved in editing, or at least it's acknowledged in the republication that the article has been changed. They worried about the goals of the publication. What kind of book is this? What are the other articles like? They worried a lot about their citation record, that it will look like they're self-plagiarizing, trying to claim two papers worth of credit for what's basically one paper's worth of work. So, and I had a space for comments, and there were really lots of very upset comments from people. They said, I was never told this. I had no idea this could happen. They stole my work. They didn't notify me. Could we use a different license? This should be illegal. I paid a lot of money. I paid, $2,000 and $3,000 to have their article appear open access and be freely available for everybody to save other people from having to pay like $20 to read their article. And now here's somebody who's making a profit out of this article. What surprised me was the response that, so I posted all this on my blog, and what surprised me was the response that I got from open access advocates. They were universally dismissive of the author's concerns. They said basically, the author should have known better. They should have read the license. They should have realized that when it said commercial use is allowed, that this could be done. They should be happy that this is happening. You're harming a cause by raising this issue. So I want to think about this and cast this in a particular way. So this is an example of what the authors are actually told if they go to the journal and they check on, tell me about your copyright, whatever. And they get this, which is a very positive description of good consequences that can come from open access publishing. And nothing in that statement is untrue, but it's kind of incomplete. And the best way to think about incompleteness is in a parallel situation that I think is relevant, and that is of informed consent. This is something that usually comes up in medical research, in clinical trials, where people are asked to participate in a clinical trial where they may receive a new treatment or they may receive the standard treatment. And they're basically being asked to do this for the good of the medical research for future patients. We might discover, we'll find out which treatment is best. This is your contribution. You might be going to die, but, your contribution will live on. But there are strict rules about what you have to tell the patients when they're considering enrolling in a clinical trial. The researchers have to design the trial to minimize harm to the patients. All of this is overseen by institutional review boards, who are a nightmarish pain in the ass for medical research. They're absolute sticklers for all kinds of stuff. So the researchers have to go back and redesign things and redesign things and redesign things. The participants have to be told about the possible harm as well as the benefit, and the researchers have to take their informed consent statements back and revise them and revise them. The onus is on the researchers to make sure that the participants are aware of the potential for harm as well as for benefit. They might only get the placebo. The new treatment might be worse than the old treatment. So what happens if we apply this framework to something like open access publishing? So again, the journal is asking the authors to accept the CC BY license, mostly because it fits with the journal's goals for open publication. And it should be the case that the journal's practices are designed to minimize the potential harm to the authors, and that the authors are told about the possible harms. And it's not just the case that the authors are given this very sparse positive description. The actual harms has to be spelled out sufficiently that the authors understand this before they commit to publishing in this journal. So here's what informed consent would look like at present for journals. You must, and it would need to, one of the problems is that authors aren't asked to sign the copyright form till the very end. You've submitted your paper, it's gone up for review, you got the reviews, you went home and cried or got drunk, and then you fixed up your article, sent it back, it went out for re-review, finally came back, oh, just fix up little things, you fix it up. Finally, they send you, here, we need you to sign this copyright form. And at that point, nobody's going to say, oh, CC BY, I don't know if I like this. Maybe I'll take my article back and go to a different journal. That ain't going to happen. So this needs to come up early in the process, at the submission step, that you have to accept the least protective. I had written, and they describe it as the least restrictive, but it is also the least protective of the licenses. Your article can be repackaged and sold commercially without your knowledge. And since you hold the copyright, the journal will not help you to protect your rights. This was quite clear from the comments. People said, if they don't like it, they can just sue the publisher. Individual authors are going to sue the publisher over four words being changed? No, that ain't going to happen either. So this sounds terrible. You think, well, no one's going to. Are people going to publish anyway? Some people will. But these problems are not intractable at all. These are very simple problems for the journals to address to minimize the harm to the authors. The first is to make CC BY the default license, but not the only license. You could have CC share alike as an alternative, which would allow reuse, but it would have to be not for profit. And since you own the copyright, the journal still has some responsibility for putting you in this situation. I mean, you have to check with the lawyers, but I think you could just have a box that you tick that says, I authorize you to take action to protect my rights as an author under the copyright that you're forcing me to use.
Just as sort of a nerd point, but wouldn't you also want no derivatives because of this problem of people editing? And
yes, you probably would want no derivatives as well. So this is a big problem, but it's not a big problem because it was only one publisher, but it's an example of unintended consequences, harm that was certainly perceived by the authors as harm, and ways that the journals could fix this and, to my mind, have a responsibility to fix it. And it should be in their interest, because a substantial fraction of the authors said, I'm not publishing open access anymore, now that I know this can happen. So this is now, this is part three. And I want to start by putting the idea of the kinds of harm that can arise from cooperative activities into an evolutionary context, because I'm an evolutionary biologist. And rigorous analysis of evolutionary processes teaches us that it's hard to evolve genes that cause cooperative or altruistic behavior. Because the behavior is in the future, it's conditional, the benefits are in the future, they're conditional, they may happen, they may not happen. There's often a cost to the individual. If there's a cost to the individual, that trumps the long-term benefits, unless the conditions are exactly right and the long-term benefits are really big. So if we want scientists to act cooperatively for the communal goods of science, we need to build structures that make it easy to cooperate, make cooperation as rewarding as possible, and that reduce the costs and risks of the cooperative behavior we want to trigger. Now, what I was going to do next was I was going to talk about the individual harms that I sort of perceived as arising sometimes, at least, out of, or the, I would say not harms so much as obstacles, barriers, things that made it hard to be open. And I made this long list of the kinds of things that I would have to, decisions I'd have to make in deciding whether to make a particular component of my research open. And this is all very valid. These are all things I would have to think about. I'd have to decide. I don't know the answer to. I don't even know where the bloody information is. Some student did the work and their notebook's incomplete. And this is a big, this is a lot of big obstacles. But I'm not going to say any more about this right now. I'll continue to gripe about this through the rest of the meeting. But I want to sort of back off a bit and consider a different perspective. And that is that for open access publishing, it succeeded because the objectives were very clear and very straightforward. We wanted research papers to be open for anyone to read, and we wanted authors to get to keep their own copyright. And these, achieving these clear objectives was straightforward, at least conceptually, that if we had journals that were not for profit, their expenses are supported by publication charges, which are kept to a minimum, which are paid by the people doing the research, so that publication costs became part of the cost of disseminating your research. They were not paid by subscription to the reader. And the cost to authors seemed clear, although there were major unintended consequences of predatory journals and minor unintended consequences, like I've just described. So if we think about, if we think about open science, it doesn't have those properties. This is taken from the meeting description. And yes, it's very worthy. We all think this would be great. This is really desirable. But they're not specific enough to actually guide action, to tell us what to do. And that's what I've noticed over, What I've noticed yesterday was that there's all these ideas floating around, but, and some of them are quite specific, like Pascal's library, which was really clean approach to a specific problem. But much of it is very well-meaning, but very diffuse, so that it's hard to tell what needs to be done, what would success look like, because we haven't defined what specifically do we want to accomplish. And so I'm going to stop there.
So I think it's maybe worth distinguishing between objections that people have when they're kind of unfamiliar with the process and the ideas, and objections that they have when they have more experience with it. I mean, so the concrete example is that when new people are introduced to the archive, frequently they're reluctant to do it because they're afraid their paper will be plagiarized. But experienced authors, I think, have exactly the opposite idea, which is that putting it on the archive means that, sure, somebody could easily copy it, but it's very easy to capture them as well.
Right.
Proof that it was out there.
Right. And that applies also to the science blogging. I keep trying to encourage people to blog about their research, and they go, what if someone steals my ideas? And I'm going, well, A, anyone who's seen my email tagline says, if you're, don't worry about someone stealing your research. If your idea is truly original, you're going to have to cram it down their throats. That's one side of it. But the other side is, once it's on your blog, once it's on the archive, you have basically date stamped it as your idea. You don't need to encrypt it. It's there public with your name on it and a date. So anybody, it's really easy to show that you originated this idea.
So but getting back to this issue about the republication, do you have some kind of breakdown in your survey between people that had kind of used open access a lot and people that...
I did ask, you know, how many papers have you published? Have you published open access papers? And there was very little, there was no correlation with sort of how many papers have you published. There was nothing really about this, probably because most biomedical and life sciences researchers are not paying much attention to copyright. But I think that distinction between apparent problems that turn out not to be real problems and problems that actually happen is a real distinction. But I think authors need to be made aware of both of those and guided in thinking about those because,
yeah.
I mean, this is a very select community, and it's very unfair to expect that the bulk of scientists will approach the problem with the kind of levels of expertise that you guys have.
But I mean, I guess my question is, how do you distinguish between the things that people are objecting to just because they're unfamiliar with it and the things that they're going to continue to object to later?
Well, because you know what the real problems are. That's why the onus is on the research, medical research, the onus is on the researchers to think about the problems, the perceived problems, the real problems, to guide the potential participants through thinking about both kinds of problems. And we have the expertise to say, this is a real problem, this is actually not a real problem, but our responsibility to authors is to help them think about both kinds of problems, not to just say, we're not even gonna mention those aren't real problems, you're just ignorant.
So I wanted to push back a little bit on this IRB analogy. So the first thing I want to say won't justify, but the IRBs are really designed to protect the public image of medical research rather than to protect the research subjects. I think if you look at how they're designed, it's really about minimizing backlash rather than maximizing subject benefit. But that's a complicated discussion. More importantly, I think, is that for those sorts of things, right, the point of medical research is to protect patients,
benefit
patients in general. Whereas science, the point is not the scientists. Right, we are not supposed to be the beneficiaries. Humanity and knowledge are supposed to be the beneficiaries. Furthermore, we're a lot more sophisticated than the average patient, and I think there just has to be a very different bar for who is going around protecting us when we're being funded by the public.
I would say that life sciences researchers certainly, and probably physics researchers too, are not a lot more sophisticated about copyright issues than the general public.
I'm sorry. I don't mean sophisticated on these particular points. I just mean they have access to people. They are smarter. But
the onus should not be on them to have to do each one of them to have to individually do the work of figuring out what the problems are. The onus should be on the experts who know what the problems are to lay them out and not hide them from the researchers. And I do not think it is fair to say, well, if the researchers really care, they can do a lot of digging and read everything over and come to an understanding and think about the unintended consequences, which were not spelled out anywhere as a risk. I think it is really unfair to expect that. And I think that the obligation of the journals. That I think that
to the researcher, that's what we're talking about. Is you're talking about protecting the self-interest of the researcher, right?
I'm talking about
the possible expense of the public.
Yes, and that is exactly the same. If we set aside concerns that it's true that legal protect your ass things apply to IRBs, but I think ethically, the same issues, it's an ethical issue as well as a legal issue in both cases. And I think ethically, we have an obligation to minimize the harm when we're asking people to do something for the greater good, whether the greater good is humanity or the ability of other scientists to access our research. We're asking them to do something for some sort of greater good. It's the onus should be on us to make sure that they know what they're getting into. Otherwise, we're tricking them, we're exploiting them.
I just wanted to comment on licensing choices, because I like thinking about licenses, so sorry. But I think the no derivatives is a bad choice. That's not considered a free culture license by...
It's a bad choice from the perspective of the goals of the journals.
No, I would say, well, so for example, no derivatives would not permit me to translate your abstract and share it in another country, right?
Right.
Without seeking...
But it would protect me...
It would.
Having you change, or having somebody, or having creationists change what I wrote. And I may decide that for me, that protection is more important than the bigger goal.
I agree.
But there are terms for derivatives, like listing what the changes
right.
are.
Yeah, I don't want to get this to get into a detailed discussion of which licenses are appropriate. The point is that authors don't have any choice at present. There is no choice, and the journals have decided, for reasons that seemed very good, to say this is the license we offer.
The authors have a choice on the archive.
Oh, yes, on the archive they do, but in open access journals, they don't. Most of them. Some of them do.
It's a journal.
But they have to be paying attention.
They have to know. And if they knew this at the beginning, they could.
That's a different thing, saying they don't have choice and saying they're not informed enough to make choices.
Yes, yes. They are not. Authors are not informed. They are not able to make informed choices.
Let's take one more question.
Simon.
So I'm thinking of the parallel to Wikipedia, where the kinds of problems, and they were very severe problems that happened. The famous one is Biography of Living Persons. Nobody foresaw what was happening there. And what I really like about your talk is that you're saying, look, we have multiple groups here that all need to be protected. And we have to have that conversation. I think that's exactly right. We, even if, like, the problems you brought up are not the final list of problems.
No, not at all.
We're going to discover new ones. If there's not a mechanism for people to complain. I mean,
and an ethical framework of what our obligations are.
Yeah, I think that's. I mean, if we want to open up to unexpected benefits, we also have to understand there may be unexpected detriments. And if there's not a sense that people can push back, then I think we're in a lot of trouble.
Well,
I
mean, you have one more question.
Oh.
Yeah, so you presented this very nice story about, like, kind of a failure in this peer reviewed publication. But you didn't touch upon how or what would be the action plan to minimize the possibility of repeating this.
Which? For the open.
The early story that you mentioned.
The arsenic.
Oh, the arsenic story.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, it's. In some ways, there are no because it wasn't that there was one fail. It was a cascade of fails, and all of those, we all need to do a better job. We need to not fall in love with our hypotheses. We need to exercise more responsible supervision of our trainees. We need to be more critical as reviewers. Yeah, there is none. That's why I'm not posting any solution. This is just the real world.
Thanks, Rosie.
Thanks. Oh.